Hey guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here today with an interview with Pat Simmons Jr. He is a musician, but also a permaculturalist on the island of Maui, and followed his work some in terms of especially working with local plants and on the island, and wanted to get kind of his story and his feedback. So, Pat, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Aloha. Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Warmest aloha. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get started with permaculture and, you know, the work that you do?
Well, yeah, let's see. Well, I've been out here in Maui since I was about 4 years old. My dad bought the land that I still live on about 25 years ago.
Wow.
And yeah, I had a unique upbringing, you know, both traveling with my father and his music, and then also being connected with the land in a pretty rural area here on the North Shore of Maui. And so I grew up around the country, grew up around the Hawaiian culture, and grew up around the ocean and the fruit trees. You know, my dad planted fruit trees now that I've been harvesting from that are 25 years old, and it's pretty to be on a property and see them grow this long and now be, you know, climbing. I climb coconut trees with my harness and everything, and get to harvest avocados and citrus and things that my dad planted when I was a little kid. And
that's amazing.
I really value that. And that's been a big part of my upbringing, is, you know, both the music and the land. And I had a unique opportunity of leaving the island when I was of age to go to college, and discovered permaculture over there. And I went to Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington.
Okay.
And ended up graduating with a degree in ecology and environmental studies, agricultural based stuff as well. And while I was in college, I saw that there was a permaculture course being held on Maui, actually right down the road from my home. And I was like, oh,
that's amazing.
Go home. So I flew home on a break, on a winter break 10 years ago, like almost 11 years ago now, I guess. Yeah, about 10 years ago. And got to study with Penny Livingston from the Regenerative Design Institute, and Brock Dolman, who's they're Bolinas, California, permaculture-based people. And so I got to study permaculture with them here in my backyard, pretty much, and got a basic introduction to it. And that kind of led me to my other teacher, Jeff Lawton, from Australia, from the Permaculture Research Institute. I learned about Jeff through his films, which I highly recommend anybody watch who's into permaculture. He has these beautiful documentaries that he made several years ago. And I watched those films. I was really blown away by them. And I'd been collecting Hawaiian plant literature and books for years and years. So kind of had this Hawaiian cultural and agricultural based background, and then got thrown into the permaculture world. And that really was just an eye opener for me in a lot of ways. So. That's what I do now, is I actually install gardens for people, and I've been planting up my own farm and just getting it going. And I eventually want to teach permaculture, but for now I'm just practicing it and getting my feet wet.
That's awesome. So for anybody who's listening, the screams are little kids taking a bath in the background after a day at the beach. So you can't cry for them too much. When you found the literature on Hawaiian planting, was it tough to find that information? Because it seems
books.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the background in terms of native culture and kind of the way things used to be, they just don't exist. And I guess a lot of them were passed down by word of mouth. Is it oral history? Is that kind of the thing? And there wasn't a lot of printed material, because I've looked for like older information in terms of Hawaiian culture, and it's tough to find.
Yeah, basically there was a handful of authors and historians that went around in the turn of the century and recorded some of the oral history from the Hawaiians. And there's a woman by the name of Mary Kavena Pukui, and she passed away years ago, but she was one of the early translators for these, white literature scientist guys that were going around trying to gather the information from the local people, and they didn't speak Hawaiian, so they got in touch with this woman named Mary Pukui, and she helped to translate a lot of the material. And so they have a lot of books by the authors Handy and Pukui, and so you'll see a couple books about that, and one of them is called Native Planters, and that's one that I value quite a bit. It was probably written in the 1930s, and
wow.
So this is old information, but a lot of it is still being practiced today in various forms. And aside from the more modern permacultural techniques that a lot of people and myself are using, there's a lot of old traditional indigenous knowledge of the land and how to interact with the plants and how the people survived here for generations with these food plants that still exist today. I mean, you can go and hike around. I've gone and hiked around in some of these remote valleys of East Maui, and there's ancient banana groves still growing where the Kanaka, the Hawaiians, they planted these ancient groves. And then when a lot of the Hawaiians left the valleys later, they left the bananas growing. And so you still find these ancient varieties way up high, which are relics really. And I grow a lot of them here, and I try to perpetuate them and spread them around the island as well. But so, go ahead.
So what makes permaculture on Maui unique compared to other places? Like, are there certain aspects of the geography or the plant life itself that makes permaculture there unique, or kind of the need to adapt?
Yeah, aside from being a place where it's pretty much, you know, where I live, it's in the, you know, high 60s, mid 70s, 80s all year round. We can pretty much grow anything any day of the year. Of course, certain things will bolt and flower, like lettuces and things will go to seed at certain times of year because of the lack of sunlight. But for the most part, I think what makes Hawaii a unique place for farming and for agriculture is the growing cycle being year round. And then also, I think one of the other things that came up for me just now was the thought of the traditional indigenous Hawaiian people still existing here and still practicing their culture in various forms, and the plant life, the same genetic cuttings of the taro and the sweet potato and the bananas and the plains that they grew. These are genetic crops that were passed down generationally. So we still have a lot of the crops I grow today were cuttings passed down, you know, 1,000 years ago here on the island. So the people have been in Hawaii for almost 2,000 years. So these crops have been sustaining them here for generations, as well as throughout the Pacific, even before people migrated to Hawaii, like taro and sweet potato and coconuts even were you know, farmed throughout the world, even before Hawaiian. So we're working with a pretty ancient palette of plants, which is pretty cool.
Was taro, which is the base crop for making poi, which is an indigenous dish, was taro imported into Hawaii, or is it native to Hawaii?
Well, there's not a lot of food plants, crops that the Hawaiians grew that were native here. They brought many things with them. They call them the canoe plants, because these plants were brought along the ocean voyaging canoes for thousands of years. The people in Polynesia and, you know, Southeast Asia brought bananas and coconuts, breadfruit, kalo, taro. In Hawaii, it's called kalo with a K. Whereas in Tahiti, where it's also grown, they use the T for the K sound. So it's taro in Tahiti. But here, people say kalo. And it's a fascinating crop. You know, I've been growing a lot of it lately and been really
young. I've seen in your post, it looks like a massive plant.
Yeah, it's really a staple food, and it's versatile, and there's many, many varieties, much like apples or avocados. You get all these different varieties, or citrus, for example. There's many cultivars of kalo, and it's all the same species, which is Colocasia esculenta, and it's all the same species. There's just different varieties, and you get these beautiful, diverse, colorful plants, which have different growing characteristics and colors and shape. And then the root itself, which you steam, and eat. It has different texture and color and flavor. So it's really, it's a cool plant to grow, and it likes a lot of water. So that's why we grow it here where it rains plenty. And there's an old Hawaiian proverb. I forget the Hawaiian proverb, but it translates in English to, the sweet potato will end the famine. And it's because sweet potato, which is native to South America actually, was brought here by the Hawaiians, you know, over 1,000 years ago. They must have gone to South America before Europeans, because they were ocean voyaging people. Mm-hmm. And they brought sweet potato back to Polynesia, to New Zealand and all the different Polynesian islands. Sweet potato was widespread, and it was a much more diverse, even though taro was more of a focus in Hawaii specifically, the sweet potato was somewhat more versatile because it could grow in really bad soil, dry, drought tolerant crop, and was a fast growing harvest. So, you know, compared to 9 to 12 months of a wait for a call, you have 3 to 4 months, maybe 6 months at the most for a sweet potato. So it's a much more fast growing crop. And like I said, that old proverb, somebody told me that recently, how there's an old Hawaiian saying, it's the sweet potato will end the famine. And so that's pretty cool. I've been growing a lot of that as well. And I'm trying to turn people onto that because it's such a quick, easy plant to grow. Mm-hmm. You just put a cutting in the ground and the thing goes off like a vine all over the ground. But like I said, these food plants have been growing here for years and years, and I've found a lot of the wild varieties growing in some of the ancient archaeological sites here where people were inhabiting for generations. You'll still find those canoe plants where they were farming here. And a lot of the Hawaiians had to leave their traditional valleys where they were homesteading.
Yeah.
Because big agriculture came in the mid-1800s, and they dammed and dried a lot of the streams that flowed, and they took all that water and they diverted it to the desert dry side of the island to grow sugarcane and pineapple. Those are the two major crops that were grown. And so to this day, many of the streams in East Maui they run dry, and because of the big agriculture that exists there now, Monsanto, large scale corn, GMO corn production is happening here in Maui. A lot of those streams are still being dewatered for a development, and a lot of corruption here on the island with water. It's sad.
Wow.
We're still dealing with a 130-year-old ditch system that even older, really, because the Hawaiian overthrow was 130 years ago. And then the ditch systems were built in the mid-1800s, so like 150 years ago, really. It's a complex situation here in Maui.
Huh. I was aware that there was a referendum a number of years ago to keep GMOs off of Maui. If Monsanto is there, I assume that referendum failed and they were able to get onto the island then.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they were actually already here. They had been here since the early 1990s. And Monsanto, owned by Bayer now.
Yeah, yeah.
They were challenged in 2014 with a group of really awake, concerned Maui's residents started a petition to get 20,000 signatures to get a GMO moratorium placed on the ballot. Ballot is a ballot initiative. And they got 20,000 signatures, and sure enough, they got it on the ballot. And we wanted to vote yes. That was the whole thing. Vote yes for the moratorium. And we got all these people, and they voted yes, and it passed. And the moratorium passed. And then you know what happened? The mayor said, "I'm not going to uphold that." And he just vetoed it.
And you're like, kidding me. You're like kidding me.
20,000 people's signatures meant nothing overnight. And the mayor, who was a lobbyist with Monsanto and just totally bought by Monsanto, his name was Alan Arakawa, Mayor Arakawa. He was the previous mayor to the one we have now. He was bought by Monsanto, and he was in full support of them and in full support of the water that they were removing from the wet side of the island. And So it's still, so to this day, we still have Monsanto here, and that nothing happened, nothing changed, sadly. And they're still using a huge amount of restricted use chemicals every day, up to 80 different pesticides in 1 week of their spraying. So it's really a sick kind of experiment, and just open air testing for seed corn for cattle feed. And that's one other issue. We have a new company here that in 2016 purchased the 41,000 acres previously in sugarcane production. Mm-hmm. So that company that used to own that was HCNS, Hawaii Commercial and Sugar. They sold it to a company from Canada and California who are like development companies, really. And they are currently trying to diversify and do diverse ag. But really, they're just tilling up thousands of acres of soil in the windiest, driest, hottest place where it's 90 degrees all day. Mm-hmm. And, just, and like 40 mile an hour winds. And they're just tilling up, making dust storms. And
I have to believe when they're doing that, they're losing a lot of topsoil too. I mean, that's,
I have videos.
That's,
I have
idiotic. Videos.
I have videos on my phone, just like driving by. I had to like try to film it because it's where there's like big, like 300 foot tall dust tornadoes and stuff going through the Central Valley of Maui. And wow. They are pretty much just desertifying it even more, because at least when it was in sugarcane production, it was all green and full of green crops. Now they're just tilling the land and planting rows and rows of like citrus and coffee and putting black plastic down and just open soil everywhere. There's no mulch, there's no soil health, there's no, it's a sad situation. And they're using this East Maui water where the streams, you know, are miles and miles away. And they're using this ancient aqueduct system built in the 1800s, which is still in existence today, of cement tunnels and ditches and flumes, iron flumes and things. Missionary family sugar planters back in the 1800s. They're still using that fragile, leaky old system today to irrigate thousands of acres of crops that aren't feeding anybody. And they're only along the roadsides. So that it looks like they're farming. It's like fake ag. So we're calling it fake ag here in Hawaii.
What's the purpose then? I mean, if they're not going to generate a real crop, like what is the purpose of tilling it up and wasting the soil?
Right, so it looks like they're farming, and they are planting, they're planting like 10,000 lime trees and 10, you know, here and there, there's planting huge amounts of things, and it's stuff that's just getting wind blown, and it's only like a few feet tall. They've only been farming for a couple of years, so they're really, they're not even really producing much food. They have like some kale and potato crops and stuff, but I haven't seen any of that for sale anywhere. And they were accused of using paraquat, which is a gnarly chemical recently. So, and they admitted to it. They admitted that they'd use paraquat to remove some weed trees and stuff. And so they're growing this food on this chemically polluted soil that's been devastated for years and for decades and, you know, 100 years. It's a sad situation, and that's what we're dealing with today in Maui. Is we're dealing with a fake ag situation where they're using cattle and other operations to keep the land in ag until it can be sold off for development, and which is what the previous owners are now doing with their land that they kept. The Baldwin family, Alexander and Baldwin, they kept a lot of the acreage for development. And so now you have these massive developments of million-dollar houses that are going up all over the island in all the old pineapple land. And it's all contaminated soil full of pesticides, it's being sold to people for big bucks because there's a huge demand for housing here. And yeah, it's a really unique and pretty sad situation here in Maui right now. I could go on and on about it, and I will. But essentially, like, for me, I'm just here homesteading on my own family's land, where I've been a privileged white person to grow up here and, you know, be on this land. But I'm, you know, being, I don't like to just call myself privileged, because I do a lot for the community, and I do a lot for my Hawaiian friends. And I'm actually a part of a team of Hawaiians and local people who are here who are reopening the ancient archaeological sites to be farmed, ancient taro patches. And every week we have a work day at a remote valley here in East Maui, where we're opening the traditional taro patches and getting the water back from the streams and clearing the weeds. And we're opening up these places to feed people and to teach the young people. And it's just by volunteer, grassroots style. Nobody's getting paid to be there. And the local Hawaiian people, many of them are in the predicament that many of us are in, where they're trying to make ends meet and just survive, because it's hard to survive here financially. And a lot of them can't practice their culture and they can't farm. They're working 9-to-5 jobs, you know, and it's a really interesting time we're in. And I think the more that I can teach my kids and the future generations around how to farm and how to be a pono, be in balance with the land, I think we're going to be able to move forward in a good way and plant the seed for a healthier future for everyone.
When I know there's a lot of conflict between Native Hawaiians and people from the mainland coming onto the island, you sound more like what would be termed a local Haole.
In some way.
Is that what kind of you see yourself?
But you know, when it comes down to it, it doesn't really matter the color of the skin these much anymore. It's like whoever shows up to Malama to care for the land, and whoever shows up to look after each other and to live in a good way, is part of the family, is part of the tribe. You know, like there's some people who are pretty stuck in that old racist mentality of, oh, like you're white or whatever, and you don't deserve to be here. But and I know some of those people too. But there's many Hawaiians that are waking up to the future that we need to work together. We cannot be divided by our race and color anymore. Yeah. And I'm treated as equal, you know, by a lot of my Hawaiian friends. And that's only because I've stepped up and used my privilege to help them and to help the land and to use my free time. You know, like I haven't had to slave over rent because I live on my family's land. That's huge. A lot of people are stressing out about rent here. And the average place is like 20, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 a month just for a home.
Yeah.
To rent. And then, but I've been on my family's land for my whole life, so I haven't had to pay rent. So a lot of my time is spent helping other people and teaching other people and sharing food from my garden. You know, like I end up giving away a lot of free food because I receive so much from my other friends. We all trade and barter, and that's a big deal here. You know, like when somebody's got a lot of something, you hook other people up, and that's just how it goes. That's the aloha spirit, you know. And when I'll come home and my brother will be like, oh, I got a load of coconuts. I left them out front of the gate. So I randomly come home and there's a load of coconuts sitting by my gate.
That's awesome.
I'll come and drop off a bunch of food at his house, you know. So it's just, that's how it is here.
It's the way it should be everywhere.
It's a very agricultural based community, at least the community I'm a part of. And, I want to touch on one thing that's unique right now that really needs to be brought to light more. And it's something that's not a comfortable topic for a lot of people, but here in Hawaii, it's becoming known that the U.S. Occupation here was an illegal act of war in 1893, when the Queen of Hawaii at the time, Queen Liliuokalani, she was put on house arrest and by the U.S. Marines in 1893 and locked up in Iolani Palace in Oahu. And there's a lot of this history is not taught in schools because they don't want to know, they don't want people to know that Hawaii is an occupied nation still. And so I just need to touch on that because that's a part of my work right now is working with these Kanaka, working with this Hawaiian, the word Kanaka is what the Hawaiians have to be called, means human. And in the language, Kanaka
Maoli. Something happened to your earpiece there. You trailed off at the end.
Any better now?
That's better. Yeah. Okay. You were talking about the occupation being illegal and you're trying to teach it young people, so. Nope, you're broken. You're broken up again.
Hey, one sec, hold on.
You're back now.
Okay. All good?
Yeah, now we're good.
Yeah, a lot of people are waking up to the fact that the occupation was never a legal situation. And
all good? You start talking about occupation and it goes soft. I don't know if we're being monitored or what. You're soft.
Hold on.
There you're good.
That's okay. I'm standing up. I'm getting back.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, it's
probably
crazy.
Just the zone I'm standing in. Probably my kids are outside now.
Yeah. All right.
So yeah, what's happened is that the Hawaiian people have started to reconnect with some of the locations where their ancestors used to live. And back when the overthrow in 1893 happened, there was a group of plantation owners, sugarcane, pineapple farmers. They were the grandchildren of the missionaries that came. And they were forming their own government. And they were actually part of like a gun club called the Honolulu Rifles. And they were a group of white, rich businessmen, Sanford Dole, you know, from Dole Pineapple, all these companies. So these are people who are Lauren Thurston, Henry Baldwin. These are the founders of the state of Hawaii. And they came and said that, okay, they're going to form a government. And they contacted the U.S. and the U.S. brought Marines over and backed them as the new, there was a military coup that happened. And they came and backed them and said, these are now the government. This is now the government. And they were actually Hawaiian citizens of the Hawaiian nation. It was a separate country. And so they, the white guys took over, and then the U.S. backed them as the new government. And that's what happened in 1893. And so a lot of people are awake to that now. And my son is here. And so back when that happened, a lot of the lands were ceded to the U.S. And the there was an old early form of sorry, can you hear me now? I'm just gonna walk a little further away. My kids are so loud. Sorry. Okay. They see me through the window and they want to come hang out with me. My wife's trying to hang out with them outside. But so what happened is a lot of these lands were ceded to the U.S. and there was an early form of land ownership in Hawaii called the Kuleana Awards Act, which was an act that the king of Hawaii at the time, King Kamehameha III, this is before the overthrow, he enacted a Kuleana Awards Act. They had a parliament and everything. They were a separate country. So they made this act, and when the Kuleana Awards Act was enacted, it made it so that Hawaiians could, for the first time, file a land claim and have their own parcel and everything. They didn't have parcel numbers back then. So it was the first form of land ownership in the 1850s, 1840s, 1850s, and on, you know. So back then they created these land claims, and somebody was awarded a separate parcel of land, and they had a land claim award number and everything, an LCA number. And all these parcels actually still exist here. There's a database of all the Kuleana awards that were awarded to families that made the claim, who could write and sign their name, you know, back then, and say, this is my land, I'm growing kalo, and it's in this area and this name of this valley. And so all these Kuleana awards still exist. And when the overthrow happened, they all went void and null and just weren't even treated as legal at that anymore. And so a lot of my Hawaiian friends are going to these places where their family has Kuleana, and which is, you know, one of the words for responsibility. And they are opening them up and farming them and clearing the weeds and trying to get food growing again. And so that's what I've been doing too, is I've been going into these Kuleana parcels and helping them to be revitalized with food production again. And some of them, people who are farming them, are challenged on other islands. You know, there's people in Kauai who are challenged by the police. They come and try to remove them, saying that this is not your land. But then the Hawaiians say, this is my land. I've got the deed right here. It's an allodial title deed in 1860 or something. And they come and they arrest a lot of them, sadly. So there's people who are trying to farm, trying to reconnect with their local land where they grew up, and not where they grew up, but where their ancestors were farming years ago, and they're becoming criminalized for doing it, like for planting food, and some of these places are just totally overgrown with weeds.
or not even, nobody's even living there. So it's really kind of a sad situation where these Hawaiians are reconnecting with their land, but it's also a beautiful thing to see these people standing strong with their culture and not mm-hmm. being determined, not being shut down.
Yeah.
And so that's just what the situation we're in is that there's these allodial title deeds that are, they happen to be, sometimes happen to be on parcels where people were living, and they're like, hey, this is my land. I bought this land for X amount of dollars. And then the haunt and it's kind of funny, like the land, leaving the land that I live on, like it's a TMK, you know, it's got a tax map key number and everything. It's not a, it's only in the form of US law that it exists. So,
is there a movement to try to reestablish sovereignty? Like, is that part of the objective is to create a sovereign government again?
Yeah, I can touch on that. So I'm a part of a group of friends. I have a group of friends who have created, not my friends, but that my friends have been involved with a larger group on another island who have created a movement called the Occupied Forces Hawaiian Army. And they are an army corps, a non-combative military government. And the head of the corps was a colonel in the US Army here on Oahu. In the Big Island. And he actually sent a letter to the US Navy about a year or two ago. And they didn't challenge him on that. They didn't challenge him on the basis that of the facts and of the history behind the overthrow. And they have established themselves as a non-combative military. And so it's a way that they can engage the US legally as an international law, through international law, to discuss these issues, because really there was no legal basis for the overthrow in 1893. It was done by illegally by international law, through Geneva Convention and all this stuff. So a lot of that is becoming aware, and I can send you some information on that. You can find more information about it through me. Anybody wants to contact me, I can send them some info about it. But essentially, the Hawaiian people are uniting more and more. There's several different sovereignty groups, but this one in particular has decided to go a more legal route than just, hey, we're sovereign people, and you know, throwing up the middle finger and whatnot, which is a lot some of the Hawaiians did in the past. They were pretty aggro, I would say. But now they're realizing that, okay, we need to stand as a respectful legal entity and not be so at war, essentially.
You have to use the tools against the aggressor. I mean, if they're going to use legal tools against you, you have to come back with legal tools to, overcome.
And essentially, a lot of these people who are active with this Hawaiian army, they're just subsistence farmers and hunters and fishermen who are concerned citizens. And a lot of them have repatriated as Hawaiian nationals and have let go of their legal US legal documents and have repatriated as Hawaiian nationals. And some of them are not even Hawaiian by blood. Some of them are white people. And because, the Hawaiian kingdom, the kingdom of the Hawaiian Islands, as it was called, was not a solely Hawaiian by blood nation. There was many people living here, just like you can live in America today and in the United States and be, of some other ancestry. There was many citizens living here at the time when the kings were and queens were running the show here. And so it's kind of where we're at right now, is like there's a movement to bring about the awareness more, I would say, and also empower Hawaiians to reconnect with their agricultural heritage as well. Mm-hmm. And to not be afraid to go and reconnect with these places that their ancestors lived, and to clear the weeds and get food in the ground. Because as we know, there's some odd times right now and uncertain times into the future where food prices are going up and up and nothing's really getting cheaper. But the land is there. And when people know how to farm it, it can change everything. So that's really what I'm up to, is I'm just practicing my agricultural skills that I've developed over the years, and my expertise is with the plants and the soil. And a lot of these Hawaiians too, like, they want to learn. Some of them don't have the skills that I've developed. And even though that their families were farmer families, they're wanting to reconnect with the action, with the practice. And so that's, I find myself as well, like, helping them learn, and we're all learning together, really.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome that you're able to give back like that. That's what real Ohana is, in terms of being able to be part of a larger family. So,
yeah, I mean, I the people that I've worked with at this workday that we've established, the Honomanu workday at Honomanu Valley, it's right on the ocean. It's this beautiful estuary, like river mouth, that empties out into the bay. And the people who've been working with that group for the past almost three years now, we're like a family. We have all of our kids all come and play together, and there's really only a handful of us that have stood through and come every week. You know, like, there's a couple, some people show up once or twice and they come get muddy, but then there's the core group who stayed and put their hands in the aina. And I feel really proud and honored to be a part of that crew, because doesn't take much except just showing up to be considered a family here in Hawaii.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people who are born and raised here who don't even come and show up and don't even really do much for the Hawaiian people, because they're just busy in their own lives, and that's okay. You know, a lot of people are busy doing what they need to do for their income and for their livelihood. And but for me, it's like, it's a no-brainer. Like, I'm just a guest here. I know that. And even though I was raised here and I've been here a long time, I'm still a guest here, and try to show up as much as I can.
That's awesome. Now, you're a musician too, so you're not only working all day, but you're working at night too, doing gigs and whatnot. So
yeah, I play tonight actually in a few hours.
That's awesome. What kind of music do you play? Was it?
I play acoustic guitar and ukulele, and I sing. And I think the music genre kind of changes depending on who I'm playing for. But I like to play kind of Hawaiian style traditional folk music, which is kind of a bluegrass vibe.
Okay.
But Hawaiian music, back when there was guitars were first introduced here, the Hawaiians kind of took it upon themselves to make their own sound, and it's kind of like a Hawaiian country vibe. And then I also play a little bit of reggae music. Roots reggae is really common here in Hawaii. Everybody loves reggae, and I grew up listening to Bob Marley and everybody else. And so I throw a little bit of that in there. And then I love the blues. You know, I was raised around American music, so the blues is a no-brainer for me. I like to play a little bit of that. And I say my original stuff is kind of an eclectic little mix of folk and kind of Jack Johnson inspired kind of folk rock sound. But then I love to throw in my traditional Hawaiian, you know, covers and stuff. And what else? Yeah, I mean, I always throw a Bob Marley tune or two in there.
That's awesome.
It's part of the roots. Part of my upbringing was Bob Marley and a lot of the, you know, early inspired artists like that. So,
yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to share your story, and especially the political dimensions. You know, I don't think that, you know, most people have an understanding of what's going on, and it happens far too often, and it, you know, things need to change if we're going to be able to survive in this world in a positive fashion. So,
yeah, there's some kind of quote floating around that says that we cannot revolt until we can feed ourselves. Because that's the honest truth is, like, we can protest all day and we can, you know, be upset at the government for this and that, but if we're not feeding ourselves and not being independent from these large corporations, then what are we really doing by protesting or spreading stuff on social media? You know, it's like people got to either walk the talk or they're not, or they're not going to be eating at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Or they're going to be eating something that's imported and
toxic
miles away and a bunch of trash. And sure, I buy things from the mainland still. I go to the store and buy stuff in plastic or whatever. You know, I've got three kids at home and I'm busy a lot, and I can't always go garden all the time. You know, like, I would say, like, 3/4 of my life is parenting and spending time with my small kids who are 5, and I've got twins that are 2, almost 2.
Wow.
3 boys. And so I'm busy a lot. I can't always be out there gardening. When I can, I'm out there harvesting, and my 5-year-old, he knows how to harvest food with me and cook it up and process it. And you know, we don't eat everything local every night, but for the most part, our diet's about 99% local, and we get things from other farmers. And there's a lot of local wild hunted meat here and fish. And it's a pretty interesting place, Hawaii. You know, it's a melting pot of cultures and cuisines. So you get a lot of the farming that I do is, and that a lot of people do here is multi-cultural cuisine based. You know, it's like Asian and Hawaiian and American all together, and Filipino and whatever. Like, it's pretty cool. The food thing here is really unique. And I find myself kind of like on my Instagram, it says musician and chef.
That's awesome.
I think you can choose which profession you are. And I said, chef.
Yeah. I can see that. I would be watercolorist and chef. I can see that.
Because when the whole COVID thing began, like, a lot of people's businesses shut down, and like my whole music life shut down for the most part. And it's barely just coming back. I play like 1 or 2 little cafe gigs a week, and that's barely enough income for me. I mostly make my income farming and installing gardens for people, which is my real passion right now. It's just coming to someone's property, showing up with all my tools and materials for a few hours, busting out a nice big garden for them. And then I walk away with you know, they get it mulched and set up with irrigation and a timer, and then they get a garden. So that's my main business right now.
That's awesome. Well, I'm going to let you get back to the kids, but again, I appreciate your taking the time to chat, and we'll have to do it again.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you. I mean, I got, and anytime you're curious about any other local Hawaiian agricultural people here, I got all kinds of cool people that would probably fit the profile for a good interview. So
that's awesome. I would love to do that. Love to do that. Shaka.
Have a great day, you guys.
Warmest aloha. I'll talk to you soon.
Well, mahalo. Aloha.
Mahalo.